You know, you cannot be too Jewish.
Thank you. I couldn't possibly agree more.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Janice C. Spector, author of 2207 South Green Road. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Too Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Too Jewish is paid for by Too Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The long run of Jewish fall festivals has finally concluded with the celebration of Simchat Torah last week, and we've entered the Jewish holiday-free season that lasts all the way up to Hanukkah. There's even a special name for the month that begins this week, Cheshvan, the single month in the entire Jewish calendar that has no holidays. It's called Mar Cheshvan, literally the bitter month of Cheshvan. But if you happen to be in the professional Jewish business, there's something rather refreshing about the conclusion of this month-long overload of holiday happenings. After a nonstop flow of festivals, celebrations, fasts, and feasts, it's actually a relief, a machaya, to get back to something akin to regular life. Don't get me wrong. I love the Jewish holiday season, and each festival has its own meaning and beauty. Each explores an important aspect of ritual and communal life. Every single festival, from Slichot through Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, from Sukkot to Shmini Atzeret and Simchat Torah, has something unique to teach us about how to live life well and meaningfully. But while this is an exhilarating period filled with festivities and people, it's also an exhausting time with many additional demands and requirements for a rabbi or cantor or both, like me. And that means that when we finally settle down to just regular Shabbat once a week, we can really appreciate the virtue of a day of rest and joy that only comes every 7 days, instead of what can seem in the holidays of Tishrei like 3 or 4 times every week. I guess at some point you really can get too much even of a good thing. However, it is not truly possible to get too much Shabbat, in my opinion. The Sabbath comes weekly to remind us that whatever else happens in our lives, we can, should, and need to take a full day to focus on something other than work or our daily routine. And that day can become a time of holiness, peace, and spirituality, especially if we do it well. Which means we need to give a little effort to make Friday night and Saturday special. Bake challah beforehand, for example. Make a delicious dinner. Put a white tablecloth on the dining room table. Fill a kiddush cup with good wine. Light candles. Attend or log on to an online Shabbat service. Make your own Friday night and your Saturday a real day of rest, family, music, and joy. To play us in this morning in that spirit, here's a Lecha Dodi, one of my favorite ones, in the Moroccan Sephardi style by Chazan Aaron Ben Susan, the prayer that welcomes Shabbat.
Lecha Dodi, likran kara, ne Shabbat,
שמול תפארת ונית הילה
Was Lecha Dodi, the song of welcome for the Sabbath Bride by cantor Aaron Ben Susan for Shabbat, coming Friday night and Saturday and every Friday night and Saturday at my own congregation Beit Simcha, in person or online. When we return on To Jewish in a Moment, our guest, Janice C. Spector, the author of the new novel, set in the Cleveland Jewish community of the early 60s, 2207 South Green Road, tells us just how odd her family really was and how it inspired her to write her new book. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has already created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us for in-person Shabbat services or on Facebook Live by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome both members and guests in our sanctuary safely, but in person. You can also call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance of the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and or Saturday morning. Email rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org or go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. You can join us every Friday night on our Facebook page as well for Shabbat evening celebration services. They're at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. We will continue to hold our services in person and by virtual experience every week. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and there are a lot of them, and they're great, are live and on Zoom. You can access those by emailing or going to BeitSimchaTucson.org and clicking on Adult Classes. Our wonderful religious school is also available in blended format, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest-growing Jewish congregation community in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Janice Spector is the author of the new book, 2207 South Green Road, a novel of love and dysfunction. Indeed it is, set in Cleveland's Jewish community. She has received awards for story and playwriting ever since she was in the sixth grade in University Heights, Ohio. Went to college in Brooklyn, worked at the New York Times for a long time, and then actually was a speechwriter for the U.S. for a U.S. congressional committee, which sounds peculiar, actually, and interesting. Good morning, and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you for having me.
So, tell us what inspired you to write 2207 South Green Road, and how much of this involved your own life?
Well, it is a house that I grew up in Ohio, and it is based on my family. And I had to debate between writing a memoir, which I really did not want to do, but how could I make these people come alive again and introduce my great aunts and uncles and my grandparents. So I chose to write fiction. Some of it is really true. Some of the incidents really happened. And those that did not happen, the participants were perfectly capable of behaving in the way that I described them.
You know, I was reminded reading the book of Maurice Sendak talking about when he wrote Where the Wild Things Are. And what he said is it was really essentially his uncles and aunts all coming over and the chaos that ensued at family reunions. It sort of felt that way in this book.
Yes, you know, I mean, I guess you call it dysfunctional, or maybe you just call them family. I have heard from people who've read the book that you don't have to be Jewish to identify with them. They have Italian families. These were their relatives. They were immigrants. They were not educated. They had their own problems, and they did the best they could. I thought the story best told from the perspective of a 10-year-old child in the house. So the character of Edna is not entirely me, it's sort of a composite, but I thought it was best told from a child sitting back and watching all this erratic behavior, which was really, my recollection growing up, sort of matter of fact. This is how they were. It was a very closed Jewish community. I lived in a Jewish bubble, and I didn't really know anybody who wasn't Jewish until I left home.
We will talk much more about what it is to grow up in that kind of insular Jewish community and the book 2207 South Green Road, which is a highly entertaining read, when we come back with Janice Spector here in just a moment on Two Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to KohanAward.com, KohanAward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is KohanAward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, TOOJewishRadio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, over 100,000 downloads on Podbean.
Introductory Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? What do Jews believe about life after death? Introductory Judaism with Rabbi Sam Kohan is an 8-month-long weekly class, Sunday afternoons. It's available in person and on Zoom. To sign up, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. There is a charge for the class and the textbook, and scholarships are available. The Introductory Judaism class is open to everyone, Jewish or not. Want to refresh and update the Jewish learning you had before your bar mitzvah? Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Or maybe you're even thinking about becoming Jewish. Register for Introductory Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. Or you can visit BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or you can email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Introductory Judaism is taught in person and by Zoom Sunday afternoons from October to May at Congregation Beit Simcha, 2270 West Einar Road, just west of La Jolla. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. This one from this week's Torah portion of Noah. When the flood receded and Noah finally reached land, he threw open the ark doors and said to the animals, "Go forth and multiply." When all the animals cleared out, only a pair of confused-looking snakes remained. "Didn't you hear me?" said Noah, annoyed. "Go forth and multiply." "We can't," replied one of the snakes. "We're adders." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well and multiply. Sorry about that one. Now a word of Torah. This coming week in Temple, we'll read the great Torah portion of Noah about the most famous sailor in all history, a man who rode out the storm to end all storms in an ark. From a forgotten Broadway show on the theme of Noah called 2x2, starring the late Danny Kaye, this song's about what happens when you finally get off the ark, a delightful tune called When It Dries.
It's natural 2x2. It's wonderful going boating with a floating zoo. Those who meet God's terms can come, pachyderms can come, teeny worms can come, even germs can come if they come together 2x2. 2x2. It's logical 2x2.
It's comfortable
2x2. It's catchy, no?
2x2. It's practical.
God has decreed to, therefore you need to.
Ham's got, Shem's got.
Go and get what them's got, Jafy, 2x2. Go make yourself 2x2. And climb aboard, plenty room for you and you know who. Lots of things are done by one.
Looms are spun by one.
Races won by one. Ships are run by one. When it comes to families, 2x2. The creepers are. The crawlers are, the flyers are, the brothers are,
donkeys and monkeys all brought their monkeys,
camels and crickets all got family tickets, Jaffy two by two.
Don't hesitate.
Two by two. It's time that you did what me and Mama used to do. Will you hug and smooch, you will. Bet your boot you will. If she's cute, you will. Feel so mutual. In a bed, it's better. Two by two.
The song When It Dries from the old musical 2x2, music by one of the most successful of all Broadway composers, Richard Rodgers, who was, of course, Jewish. And his most famous partners were the Jewish Lorenz Hart and the descended from but not raised as a Jew Oscar Hammerstein. And, of course, Danny Kaye himself was Jewish. And Noah wasn't, since Judaism hadn't been invented yet. In any case, the great tale of Noah is shared to one degree or another by other ancient books of lore and legend, most notably the Sumerian epic of Gilgamesh, another guy who had to build a big boat to save humanity. But rather than read to you an ancient Akkadian, I thought David Steinberg's version of the moral of the Noah story would play better.
Noah! Shem, Ham, and Japheth, all three of whom had an IQ totaling 17. The Bible states explicitly that Noah was a righteous man in his generation. The Bible does not add words. Why do they say in his generation? Because we find out later on in Genesis that Noah liked to drink. He was, in fact, a drunk. The Bible states it clearly. Later on, Clifford Odets backs it up. My contention is this. If you had to live in a boat with 10,000 mating hippopotami and those three sons for conversation, you too would be righteous only in your generation.
There's just something inherently comic about being stuck on a big boat with a whole bunch of animals. After the Garden of Eden story and the Exodus tale of the crossing of the sea, I suspect Noah might be the single best-known biblical text of all. It's probably a combination of the animals and the rainbow. Between those two, you get everybody involved, from preschool kids to college co-eds, dorm rooms. And once you toss in that dove of peace, you have another oft-used universal symbol. Tons of marketing opportunities for the manufacturers of toy animals and rainbow pillowcases. But like so many biblical tales, there's more to that story than meets the eye. It begins, after all, with people doing evil. And it ends with more people doing more evil, in spite of the flood and the ark and the dove and the rainbow. The real message is that we need something beyond mere symbols or leaps of faith to motivate us to be decent, good human beings. We need a structure of justice and morality that the Torah will ultimately provide. Civilization means we follow basic standards of conduct in the service of creating a world in which we can all live, without bringing destruction on ourselves or our own planet. Looks like we still have some learning to do. May we learn. When we come back on Two Jewish, our guest, Janice Spector, shares what's unique about the story she tells in 2207 South Green Road, her new book, and how growing up in an intensely Jewish family can be like participating in a remarkably strange experiment of some kind. She's great. Find out all about her and her book when we return on Two Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
During his recent visit to the U.S., Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett struck a new and welcome tone with American audiences. After addressing the U.N., he spoke to national Jewish organizational leaders in Manhattan. Bennett talked about how much Israel could learn from American Jews and how important it was for the two poles of the Jewish community to have a mutually respectful conversation. You have our back, and it just means a lot, Naftali Bennett said. He added later, doesn't mean we're going to agree on everything. We're not. But we're going to talk to each other, and we're going to listen to each other. He also suggested that Israel and American Jewry should enter a new era. For decades, American Jews gave tens of millions of dollars to support Israel's development. Now, Bennett said, Israel's doing fine on its own and should move beyond acting just as a refuge for persecuted Jews. Since the inception of Israel, and actually it predates the inception, Israel's been the project of the Jewish people, but we're doing okay, he said, citing Israel's strong economy and tech sectors. Now we have to redesign our relationship. The first thing, Israeli Prime Minister Bennett said, facing a room full of the leaders of the American Jewish community was, I wish my mom were here. The son of American immigrants to Israel, Bennett, like his predecessor, Bibi Netanyahu, speaks a fluent, nearly accentless English. He spent years living in New York as both a child and adult. But in other crucial ways, Bennett sounded a different tone from Netanyahu in his first public address to American Jewish leaders as prime minister, without making any concrete policy promises. Bennett didn't make any statements about enshrining religious pluralism in Israeli policy, an issue important to the people he was addressing. He hit the same notes on Iran as Netanyahu, vowing to prevent it from obtaining a nuclear bomb and saying Israel will not outsource our security to anyone, even our best friends. Bennett seemed happy to forego policy discussions in general in favor of a charm offensive. He sought points of commonality with the crowd, talking about how his mother couldn't find American cereal when she moved to Israel, and about how he was in New York City on 9/11. If Bennett wanted to charm the crowd, it appeared to work. When the prime minister ended his speech by saying, I love you, he got a standing ovation. Rabbi Moshe Tendler, an expert in Jewish law and medical ethics, died last week at the age of 95. A dean of the rabbinical school and a professor of Jewish medical ethics and biology at Yeshiva University, Tendler was expert in issues of Jewish law and medical ethics. He was most famous for the fierceness with which he advocated the Jewish legal position that brain death constitutes death, allowing Orthodox Jews to donate and receive organ transplants in the case of brain death. He was also known for the sometimes dismissive attitude with which he regarded those who disagreed with him. When a group of rabbis issued an opinion concluding the cessation of heartbeat rather than brain death constitutes death, he denounced them publicly, an act unusual in the typically sober world of Orthodox Jewish law decisors. You say a thing, I believe you're ignorant on this topic, Tendler said in 2011. That's not an insult, it's a fact. Born and raised on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, Tendler was immersed in the dual pursuit of rigorous secular and religious studies from a young age under the tutelage of his mother, a law school graduate, and his father, head of the Rabbi Jacob Joseph Yeshiva. Tendler grew up just a few blocks away from Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, perhaps the most important Orthodox rabbinic authority in the United States in the 20th century. Tendler eventually became Feinstein's son-in-law. Tendler met Feinstein's daughter Shifra when she approached him at a public library in the neighborhood to ask a question about chemistry. After that, somehow I managed to come more often to the library to study, Tendler recalled. He studied at NYU, was ordained at Yeshiva University in 1949, and got a doctorate in microbiology from Columbia University in 1957. In his tenure teaching biology and Talmud at Yeshiva University, he taught hundreds of both doctors and rabbis. In addition to teaching, Tendler also served as the rabbi of the community synagogue in Muncie, New York, from 1967 until his death. Tendler became an important influence on Feinstein's halachic positions on questions of Jewish law and medicine, and served as a bridge between the scientific experts and the experts in Jewish law and ethics, writing articles in top medical journals as well as for Jewish scholars. He used to sit with Rabbi Feinstein, would describe the science behind it. Rabbi Feinstein would ultimately make the rulings, but Rabbi Tendler was his interpreter of much of the scientific knowledge, said Alan Jotkowitz, professor at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev, director of the Jacobovitz Center for Jewish Medical Ethics, and director of the Medical School for International Health and Medicine. He was a personal role model that there's no conflict between scientific knowledge and Torah. He said you could see God's wisdom in the Torah, but Rabbi Tendler also thought you could see God's wisdom in nature and studying nature, said Jotkowitz. On a similar subject, there was an interesting article in the magazine section of the Israeli newspaper Haaretz last week about the diminishing diversity of bird species around the city of Jerusalem. The most famous and kind of the national bird of Israel, the quaint and dramatic hoopoe, is now rarely seen there, as are a number of other native species of avian. They have been replaced by aggressive bird invaders, such as the hooded crow and the jackdaw, which have taken over the habitats the native birds used to frequent and driven them from the skyscape. The reason for this appears to be that Israeli municipal authorities in Jerusalem have been cleaning up areas of thistle and thorns and unimproved nature and installing picnic tables, playground, walking and hiking and biking paths, and soccer fields, making these more attractive and useful to humans in the capital city of Israel. But that has opened up those areas to aggressive species of birds like starlings, who drive out the more timid native birds, not to mention cats and other animals who prey on the vulnerable native birds. It's a funny problem. The municipal authorities are improving the city for residents, but by doing so, they're making it tougher on the native feathered residents. There's now an effort to persuade citizens that the wild and unimproved areas, which can look rough, filled with thorns, brambles, and messy dead brush, are crucial to the ecological health and diversity of Yerushalayim. And they are trying to re-educate Jerusalemites about the issue of, in particular, birds. All of which reminds me of a beautiful poem by a teacher of mine, Rabbi Stanley Chayat of blessed memory, called The Doves of Jerusalem. It goes, I love the doves of Jerusalem, which sail and squabble over the Temple Mount and nest impartially in the Western Wall and the Dome of the Rock, the Yeshiva Porat Yosef, and the Museum of Al-Aqsa. These doves, they are lovers of Jerusalem as she is, in her messiness and her frenzy. No doubt they pray, these doves, daily, three times and five, for the peace of Jerusalem. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World.
Introductory Judaism offers everything you ever wanted to know about Judaism, but were afraid to ask. Who is Abraham? What is the Torah? What do Jews believe about life after death? Introductory Judaism with Rabbi Sam Kohan is an 8-month-long weekly class Sunday afternoons. It's available in person and on Zoom. To sign up, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. There is a charge for the class and the textbook, and scholarships are available. The Introductory Judaism class is open to everyone, Jewish or not. Want to refresh and update the Jewish learning you had before your bar mitzvah? Want to know what your new Jewish relatives are all about? Or maybe you're even thinking about becoming Jewish. Register for Introductory Judaism by calling 520-276-5675. Or you can visit BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or you can email rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Introductory Judaism is taught in person and by Zoom Sunday afternoons from October to May at Congregation Beit Simcha, 2270 West Einar Road, just west of La Cholla. For your very own entry or return to Judaism, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Janice Spector is the author of 2207 South Green Road, a novel of love and dysfunction, set in the Cleveland insular Jewish community in the early 1960s. By the way, in the interest of full disclosure, I'm married to a woman from Cleveland whose community in that city goes back several generations, so it struck a chord, the whole book. And I promise I won't play Jewish geography biography on it, though. Janice Spector worked for the New York Times for a long time, moved to Northern Virginia, and focused on political and media consulting. Her last employment was as a speechwriter for a U.S. congressional committee. Can I ask you which committee?
Yes, I worked for Oversight and Government Reform, and many of us were tasked to write speeches for the members. I told people that I was a fiction writer at that point.
Well, you were well on your way to writing a novel then, weren't you?
Right.
Especially if it's the Oversight and Reform of Government. There's definitely a lot of fiction going on there. Tell us a little bit about the character of Edna, the protagonist, and the kind of choices you made. She seems to delight in the weirdness in her family.
Well, yes, she did delight in the weirdness of her family. She didn't necessarily think they were weird. My memory as a child was just that that's how they were. I didn't realize until I was an adult that my grandmother had significant issues that might have been dealt with much differently psychodynamically were she to be alive in today's age. But, you know, everything was very matter of fact. You know, the family gatherings, everybody calling each other every 5 minutes to see what was doing, everybody, you know, wanting to know what was going on with everybody else's life. And the strange thing about it is that University Heights, although it was a very closed Jewish community, when I went to elementary school, you could only pick out the non-Jewish children. There were only a couple of them. At the same time, it always struck me in retrospect that they celebrated Christmas. We had Santa Claus come, you know, to school and everything like that. And my family, particularly my grandparents, who were European, were just appalled at the fact that they lived in this Jewish community, but they sent their granddaughter to a public school that you know, has Santa Claus.
Celebrated Christmas, right. Right, right.
Yes.
Was there anybody in school on the high holidays?
Well, I don't know because I didn't go.
Silly question. Rabbi, what's wrong with you? Don't you obvious?
Probably not. As I said, unlike when my son went to school in Virginia, where you could pick out the Jewish kids in the classroom because there were so few of them, there were only a couple of children who were not Jewish. So I'm just going to assume that they were good students and showed up that day.
Okay, I have to ask a question. What's a floor scraping business?
He sanded and refinished floors.
So it's a refinishing, floor refinisher, Racy. We call that today.
Yes, and he was very successful. I mean, he was non-educated, but he was a very, very strong, physically strong man. His father had owned an apple orchard in Kiev and a tavern, and he came over here, and all he could find was physical labor. So he built a very successful business with all the hotels in downtown Cleveland, and had by the time he passed away, had built quite a little floor scraping empire, all of which was unknown to me as a child. I knew my grandparents were well off, but, you know, I lived upstairs of the two-family house, and it was just, you know, all the same. Their success was really sort of unknown to me.
I don't think I'm giving away too much in the novel when I say that people start to die.
Yes.
Tell us why you came up with that device and how it worked.
Well, the death that I portrayed in the novel really happened. And they happened just about the way I described them, with the exception of one that is a suspicious, you know, death. But I think it was a lot of the child, you know. Relatives started dying in quick succession. And I was just sort of stepped away from the whole thing. You know, what does it mean that somebody dies? You know, nobody ever explained anything, you know, to me. I remember that the conversation in the family used to turn to the Jewish undertakers, who were reviled by the family because of how much money they charged to bury people.
What was the most fun thing that you found in writing the novel? What did you enjoy the most?
The ability to go back and capture them as they really were in real life, so that people who read the book will know who they were more or less and have some memory of them. I only ran the manuscript past one person, and it was the son of one of the characters in the book. I know I write about the character of Rosalie, but she actually had two brothers. And I ran the manuscript past him because I wanted to make sure it was authentic, that he felt that I captured these people as they were. And he said to me he could feel them as he was reading the book. He felt like he was in the room with them. And then I knew that I achieved what I had wanted to achieve.
You mentioned that it's kind of a universal story, even though it's obviously very deeply immersed in the Jewish community, and these are Jewish families. It's a very intense Jewish family. But people have told you it feels kind of universal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, certainly. I mean, the jealousy between the sisters and the brothers, those who were successful, those who were not successful, the secret. The fact that some people knew what was going on, other people didn't know what was going on. The parachuting without notice into the family situation. And I have to tell you, I took that very matter of fact growing up. The incident in the book where an aunt breaks down a door because she thinks somebody's dead inside the house actually happened. And I didn't realize until I went out into the real world, like, well, maybe not so much. Maybe that was just your family, you know?
Well, maybe it was just your family.
Do
you think families are, Jewish families are, that you know now, are they like this now?
I think they're, some of them are very emotional. The thing that struck some people about the characters in the book, they were surprised that they weren't formally educated and intellectuals. And of course you wanted to say, well, of course they weren't. They came here, you know, some of them in their early 20s, you know, lack of education. They had a much different perspective on their everyday lives. They stressed education, which I always associate with Jewish families, you know, today. I remember growing up that the greatest thing you could get in the United States was an education. That was the most important thing to them. And I think a lot of Jewish families, but not only Jewish families, emphasize that today, how important, you know, that is. So I think that's sort of a thread that went from generation to generation. The thread that did not go from generation to generation, thankfully, was that they had almost an unspoken fear of anyone who wasn't Jewish. I mean, if you brought somebody home from school, the first thing they'd say to you, is he Jewish? And sometimes you'd say, well, I don't know. I didn't ask him, you know, as an adult or something like that.
Right.
I don't think you see that so much today. I think people are much more into being multicultural.
There were some really great little elements in the story. You know, they pull out an album, Connie Francis Sings Jewish Favorites. Some of the detail is just great. I assume they probably also had Perry Como singing Kol Nidre.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I remember it like it happened yesterday. My grandfather loved Connie Francis. He used to sing a song called By Mir Bistu Shane. You know,
sure.
He used to just love that. And so I understand a little bit of Yiddish because they basically spoke Yiddish to each other and broke in English to me. It was also the era, if you can believe it, if you remember, on the Ed Sullivan Show, where Charlton Heston read the Bible on television.
Right. Tell us a little bit about Cleveland as a Jewish community. You've now been in New York, D.C., you've lived many other places. Tell us a little bit about reflecting back on that Jewish community specifically.
Well, it was different in the sense that it was very underdeveloped where they lived in University Heights. It was a suburb that has not really become a suburb. It was mostly all country. My backyard was filled with, you know, blackberry bushes and blueberry bushes until the builders came in and built new developments. There were trees down the street that were just lined with apple trees. And slowly but surely, all the Jewish vendors moved in. The pharmacy, the bakery shop, everybody who moved into the community was Jewish. It was mostly conservative and Orthodox. It wasn't until I was, I would say maybe 10 or 11 years old, that Reform synagogues moved in. And that was sort of an oddity to people, because most of them belonged to conservative, you know, congregations. I remember quite vividly having the experience at the Jewish bakery down the street. I worked as a teenager, and I worked with a woman who was very hard to get along with. And I remembered one day seeing that she had a number tattooed on her arm. And so, of course, I went home, and my mother explained to me that she'd been in a concentration camp.
Sure.
And even though it was post-World War II, even as a teenager, that was sort of a rude awakening to me. I can't tell you that I was aware, even by that time, you know, of really the ramifications of the Holocaust. It was something almost people didn't talk about.
No, that's right. I remember going to the bakery in Los Angeles with my mom and seeing, you know, a woman reach out to get food and having the tattoo on her arm and trying to figure out what it meant.
Right.
Not much after that. So there was a lot. Was there a lot that just wasn't discussed, do you think?
I think so. Certainly my grandmother's physical and medical and drug problems, I found out after the fact, was not as wide known in the family as I thought it might have been, because nobody really knew how to deal with it. I think there was just a lot that they kept, you know, secret. They certainly, the more successful members of the family, kept their successes secret from the poorer members of the family. Sort of, they didn't want to be asked for money or help or things like that. As close-knit as the family was, they built walls between each other. And I think for those that were the immigrants, not necessarily their children, it was sort of a survival mechanism, because they were in a new place where they all had to make their own way, and they did the best they can, and they kind of wanted to keep it simple. And so everybody's particular tourist was sort of kept within the each little unit until it spilled over, in the case of my grandmother, when it could no longer be a secret.
Sure, when everything breaks down. Just one last question. What was the most difficult thing about writing this novel?
It was very poignant for me to remember and discuss my grandfather, because I was working at the New York Times when he passed away. I had made a trip to Cleveland hoping to see him. He was hospitalized at the time, but I was only there for a day or two, and it was always, next time I'm in town, I'll see him. And of course, there was next time. You always think you have more time, but you don't necessarily
sure.
always have more time.
Of course.
I think in retrospect, it was just the sadness of how the problems in the family might have been dealt with had people been more educated, even the clinicians, more sophisticated. I mean, nobody would have treated my grandmother in today's era the way she was treated, you know, back then. They would have gotten her appropriate counseling and health, and certainly not the kind of medications they gave her. I found in research, though, that her problems were not unusual for women of her era, that many women my age had grandmothers with similar problems. It was just something, you didn't talk about the problems. You just, you know, gave somebody something to make them go away. So it was kind of painful and sad, because she was my grandmother and I loved her. And I always wonder, you know, what if a different time and place it could have been like for her.
Where can people go to find out more about you, Janice, and about 2207 South Green Road?
Well, I do have a website, janicespector.com, and I will gladly, you know, answer any inquiries, you know, about the book. The book is available just about, you know, everywhere.
Everywhere books are sold.
And yes, everywhere books are sold. And it's kind of a time that's been lost. You know, the 50s are remembered in a very gentle mode by most people, but there was an undercurrent of things that were very, very sad at the time. And I hope that the book captures both the good and the bad.
I think it does. It's a great read and highly recommend it. 2207 South Green Road by Janice Spector. Thank you so much, Janice.
All right. Thank you for having me.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be author Derek B. Miller, award-winning writer of the new novel, How to Find Your Way in the Dark. It's a great book. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services and Onig Shabbat, starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, or join us online. Our playout this morning comes for Shabbat. It's in just 6 days. My friends, may you have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of health and peace.
Thank you.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.